Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're streaming live at KUCI.org. We will also be podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Amazon. So a few days after the show is on, you can go to iTunes and other places and listen to it again or send your friends to it. This interview was recorded on Thursday, January 14th, 2021. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here today with Vicki Hendricks, the author of the noir novels Miami Purity, Iguana Love, Voluntary Madness, Sky Blues, and Cruel Poetry, the latter a finalist for an Edgar Award. Vicki also writes short stories, which can be found in various collections, including Florida Gothic Stories, Dangerous Sex, Three Stories, and Miami Noir, published by Akashic. Vicki lives in Hollywood, Florida, and taught writing at Broward College for 35 years. Her plots and settings reflect participation in adventure sports, such as skydiving and scuba, and knowledge of the Florida environment. Love of animals, apparent in her earlier novels, comes to the forefront in her novel, Fur People. Hi, Vicki.
Hi.
I'm so happy to talk to you. I discovered your noir fiction some time ago. It might have been in the anthology Miami Noir, published by Akashic. Yet you are one of the first women in recent times to write and publish noir. Actually, I have read that you're the queen of noir. And I read it in an article on noir versus hardboiled, and it talked about your first novel, Miami Purity, that came out in 1995. And so I kind of love that. I mean, do you think of yourself as the queen of noir?
Well, actually, there are lots of queens of noir. I've seen that title used. I've also been called the high priestess by Dennis Lehane, so I'm hanging on to that one.
Yeah, I love that.
And I don't know, various titles. I did like the queen, but then, you know, I heard other queens, so.
But you know, what happened in the mid 90s that you started writing noir? Did you start writing it before that? And it just happened to be published then?
Well, I started writing it while I was doing my master's in creative writing. So that would have been, you know, early 90s. But I really didn't know what it was. And I didn't realize I was writing it. Actually, one of my instructors, Lynn Barrett, who's a well-known short story writer, recommended that I read James M. Cain. I'd never read him. And I just fell instantly in love with so many of his things. Mm-hmm. And Postman in particular, Serenade, though I love Serenade. And so that really introduced me to noir, but I didn't really pay any attention to it. I thought of it more as black and white movies, and I just didn't look it up. I was really busy teaching and writing and taking classes, and I just loved Cain. So what happened along the way, I took a class with James Hall, who's also a well-known writer, I would say he's more hard-boiled, not really noir, but he's probably done some noir stories. Anyway, we had to use a model and write the first third of a novel. This was along in my second year or something like that. And since I was crazy about James M. Cain, and The Postman Always Rings Twice in the paperback I had was, I think, 99 pages, I thought, well, you know, I don't really have time. There were a couple people in the class. One was doing Lolita as a model. One was doing Catch 22. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm not up to that. But a third of 98 pages didn't sound so bad. 98, and you had to do manuscript pages, which it came out to, I think, 53 pages that I had to have. And so that seemed okay to me. And that's really where Miami Purity started. It became my thesis. And then after it got published, which, okay, there's a lot of goings on in between there. the publisher said it was noir, or the editor, I guess. And I thought, oh, okay. And then I just got writing noir. But I had always loved Patricia Highsmith and, you know, the and other dark, you know, kinds of writing. Harry Cruz was a favorite of mine, and he's not really described as noir, but I would say he is. I also read a lot of Charles Bukowski, and he's not noir either, but it's also, you know, very dark stuff.
Yeah.
And I think all that, you know, was part of why I like noir, even though I didn't know what it was. And then, of course, after the book came out, people started asking me about noir, and I had to learn what it was and find out other people who wrote it. And so then I started to educate myself after that.
That's so interesting that it came out of your MFA program, because most MFA programs seem to be focused on literary fiction, and very few really support any kind of genre fiction.
And, well, I think, you know, FIU, Florida International University, is much different from some of the other ones, you know, like take Iowa, for example. They sort of consider themselves the working man's or working person's, you know, master's degree or something in creative writing, because they want people to actually write stuff that's going to get published and be able to get jobs. And they've had a lot of success with people writing mystery and noir, and Dennis Lehane came out of that program. He was in my class along with Barbara Parker, who's deceased, and many others since I graduated. I think that was 92, I'm not sure. 94, maybe 94. No, I think it was before that. Anyway, I don't know. It's all so long ago, but it seems like yesterday, of course. They focus on what you want to write. If you want to write, I don't know of any romance novels that anybody has ever done, but you could do book of essays, book of short stories, you can do literary, you can do, you know, genre. And the hard boiled and the noir, those are really respected because, you know, they have a lot of voice generally, and a good plot. I know, you know, literary fiction, often not much happens. And,
right.
You know, it has a certain status, but I think people would rather get their novels published and make some money and, you know, do it that way in a lot of cases. I mean, if you're not going to be able to teach at a university, which those jobs are pretty hard to get, then, you know, and maybe you don't even want to do that, then, you know, to be able to write a mystery novel or something, you know, what's wrong with that, really?
So the short stories came later after the novels?
No, because that's mostly what we did, you know, in the program, write short stories. And I really think short stories are harder than novels, other than, you know, they don't take as long. But I think I learned everything that I needed to know writing short stories before I started the novel. But having that model really helped, I'll tell you.
Yeah. So Miami Purity, Michael Connelly has a nice quote on here, a nice quote on a few of your books, actually. This one says, "Sex and murder, sunny places and shady people. Miami Purity is a modern noir masterpiece." That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I like it. I was going to say the model thing, you know, you don't really try to write it like the book you're using, but we did a lot of counting, you know, scenes and characters and chapters and, you know, kind of, you know, how many places are they going to go, and how much dialogue per description and things like that. So it, you know, it sounds like you're just copying, I guess, but really it just kind of gives you a way to start and a way to confine it, I guess. And I picked up on the classic noir plot structure, I think, or with the triangle and a betrayal, love triangle and betrayal, which again, I didn't realize this was classic noir, but I liked that and worked with that, you know, and then kind of took off from there, and the plot doesn't really stay the same. Camus, by the way, also used that same book, The Postman Always Rings Twice, as a model for The Stranger.
Really?
So really? I didn't find that out till later, but then I felt really good about it.
Well, this, you know, Miami Purity, who knew that, and I'm not really giving anything away because pretty soon you find out it's the name of the dry cleaners where a lot of the action takes place. How did you come up with that? The title and the name of the dry cleaners?
I don't know. I guess it sounded kind of ironic. I remember I kept trying to think of another title because I didn't really like it at the time. And my editor was Sunny Mehta. That was, you know, that came about in kind of a fantasy that I never even dreamed. But he was okay with looking for another title. And then it just, I don't know, I couldn't think of anything else. And now I think, well, I really like it. I don't know why I didn't like that. But, you know, the idea of the dry cleaner is clean on the outside and then it was extremely dirty underneath in, you know, several ways. So it just worked out. But, and then I don't know, I somehow got on these two word titles, Iguana Love, which I really like that title anyway, and Voluntary Madness. That one, the editor and publisher really tried to talk me into a different name, but nobody could ever come up with one either. So, and then it turns out there was a true life story of someone who went into an insane asylum and pretended to, you know, have some problem, and she called it Voluntary Madness. So if you look for Voluntary Madness, you probably get that.
There's something to two-word titles, huh?
I guess. I don't know.
You know, it does seem that titles, there's a few books that have really long titles that I really love, but I can never remember them.
That's true. They are easier to remember, the two words.
I guess they fit on the cover better. I don't know. That's interesting. But how did you get Sunny Mehta as an editor? Talk about selling your first book. Miami Purity.
Okay, well, this is kind of a fun story for me anyway. he died not too long ago. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's been a year or two by now. I don't know. I've lost all track of time since the whole COVID thing.
Right.
But he, you know, was with Random House. Anyway, let's see. I didn't really do much looking for an agent or anything. I think I might have sent to one person or something. I really just didn't think it would get published because, you know, when you talk to other people in the programs and everything, it all sounds so difficult to get published. And the book was loaded with sex, which, you know, made the, you know, whole process of, you know, talking about and everything class fun and, you know, using it for my dissertation and all that. But I just thought, you know, nobody's going to publish that. So I really, and I was teaching and I was so busy and I didn't really work on it. So, but then I guess Les Standiford, who was the head of the creative writing department, had an agent. And I didn't ask him for his agent or anything, but somebody else told me who his agent was. So I sent, I guess, a few chapters to his agent saying that, you know, I had been in his class and I was in at FIU and got my degree. And then he called me up and I was amazed, you know, I never expected anybody to call me up. And I talked to him and he said, oh, well, I don't know. It's interesting, but maybe you should set it in a coffee shop instead of a dry cleaner's and make the man the murderer instead of the woman and don't kill the dog. So I was like, okay, well, I'll think about that. I mean, that would have changed the entire book.
Right.
And I, you know, my first thought was, well, there's no way, but I never talked to an agent, never thought I would. So I didn't want to just throw it away that easily. So I said, well, let me think about it. And I was going to something in California called the Art of the Wild, I think. It was a writer's conference and we were staying in like the Olympic Village or something. I don't know.
You were up at Squaw Valley. You went to Squaw Valley.
Yes. Yeah. I'm dredging this up. And since then I've been to so much stuff, it all blends together. But so anyway, I guess I mentioned that to him. And while I was there, then I was sitting in a class. This would really be a fantasy, except I never had the fantasy that I would get published. Somebody came with a note. We were outside in a circle and somebody brought a note and it said, your agent called and Sunny Mehta is interested in your book. And this was really confusing. And this was during the class. And I said, and so people were like looking at it. And I guess, you know, I said something about it or something. Somebody asked me, I don't know, but I said, I don't have an agent. And I didn't know who Sunny Mehta was anyway. And somebody then pulled me in on, oh, big New York Random House editor, you know, and I was, okay, all right, great. But I thought this is a joke or a mistake or something. And so I just, and it was, I don't know, 4 o'clock or something on a Friday afternoon. And I guess everything was closed by the time I got the message or whatever. So it said, he'll talk to you on Monday or something like that. So I thought, well, okay. And then people, you know, started to talk about this and everybody was buying me drinks and oh, it was just great. You know, I had no idea what was really going to come out of this. I thought nothing, but enjoy it while it's happening. So, and then, you know, it ended on Sunday, went home. Then I had a trip to Peru coming up like the following week I was supposed to go. And that was 3 weeks or something. It was a long trip. So, and I'd really been looking forward to that. It was with Earthwatch. We were going to collect bugs and things and walk around the jungle. And anyway, so then Monday I talked to the agent and apparently Sunny Mehta had already read it. He had sent it to him without telling me he was going to send it to anybody. And he'd read it, loved it, and wanted to meet with me right away. So then I had to say, sorry, I'm not going to be around for, you know, 3 weeks or whatever it was. And they were like, okay, well, we'll come down to Miami and meet with you and, you know, talk about this. And I didn't think this was a done deal or anything. And I'm, you know, going up Machu Picchu going, you know, trying to call all these spiritual powers going, buy the book, you know? And then I got home and he came to Miami and we had dinner and said he wanted it. And, you know, that was that. It was like and then offered me a whole ton of money that I just couldn't believe. And which people have told me that was a problem because when you get a bunch of money on your first book, it's just all downhill from there. Right. And that has been the case, but I have never, ever regretted it. It was wonderful. And, you know, I've just got a great start, got book tours before people really didn't get many of those anymore and treated lavishly and, you know, and then I continued to make money, just not like the first one. And so, you know, I really, It was great. That's all I can say. My life would have been so much different. And I don't think I had the time to do all the building up of, you know, the Facebook stuff and all that. So I was in it and had most of my books out before you had to do anything like that, which, you know, I'm not good at.
Yeah. What a great story. What a great story.
Oh yeah. It was a dream come true, but I'd never dreamed it.
Well, you are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus, and I'm with Vicki Hendricks, and we were just talking about Miami Purity. Maybe we should back up a little and talk a little bit about the subgenre of noir and how it differs from, say, hard-boiled, because a lot of people, a lot of writers and readers that I run into don't quite understand what noir is.
Well, there are many definitions, and you wouldn't believe how many panels I've been on trying to define noir. Not lately so much, but years of panels at various, you know, book fairs and mystery writers conferences and things like that. And there's no one definition. I tend to stick with the old one. I started to tell you a little bit about it, the James M. Cain love triangle with a betrayal. And, you know, the narrator to me has to be the one who commits the murder. If the detective is, you know, after the murderer, and, you know, the detective is an alcoholic and he has some bad habits and whatever. I think of that as more hard boiled. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's going to have a happy ending because he's going to solve the crime. It might not be the happiest thing because it's all dark stuff, but he's going to solve the crime and go on to the next book in the series. And, in noir, you really can't have that, in my definition, because the person kind of starts at the bottom at the beginning of the novel and then drills down deeper. And you know, the best you could say is at the end of the book, the person has learned that they're never going to change. They're never going to get any better, and they're going to live with it, or they're, you know, they maybe just escape prosecution, but their psychology has been further deranged. You know, they're generally somewhat twisted in the beginning, and that's really the whole problem. Twisted, generally no education, no money, you know, really on the bottom, and then thinking that they have a chance to better themselves by doing all the wrong things. So to me, that's really, you know, what is the classic noir. And if you've got bad guys who are bad, you know, some people will call that noir because you have some really dark characters in there. But to me, that's, I guess, falling into hard boiled, or it could just be detective, mm-hmm, mystery, mm-hmm, whatever. So I just really like writing from the point of view of the person who's twisted and committing the crimes. And what? I don't know why. And apparently this isn't shared by many women or that many writers in general, and not enjoyed by a huge audience of readers. So what a choice, huh?
I mean, it does seem that there's this upsurge of noir by women, but, you know, when I look down the list of names on you know, authors, you know, classic noir novels, it seems mostly men. And so I am curious, why do you think, I mean, it does seem like women are writing more noir. Do you see that? Or do you think it just goes in phases?
I don't know. There was kind of a burst of noir by women from the 40s to the 70s, which is kind of the period of when noir was really hot And then I sort of revived it unknowingly in the 90s, but and put more lot more sex in it. But there were, you know, besides Patricia Highsmith, there were several women noir writers who were, you know, pretty prolific and you know, did a good job and carried it on. But then, I don't know, it dropped out sort of, and men continued more. But then again, you've got a mixture of hard boiled and all that other stuff in there. And now I would say maybe we have more hard boiled women writers than noir writers. I don't know. Sarah Paretsky, she's been around for a long time. I would actually call her hard boiled, but a lot of people call her noir. But you know, she is a detective that comes back. So for me, that cancels out noir. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm being very strict. It's not like it really matters, you know, if you write something you like and other people like. And obviously she has a huge ongoing audience she has for years. So people really like the detective and like that, you know, world that is created in a series that you can keep visiting again. Whereas I create a world and then it's over with because the person is kind of done for at the end. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, maybe not the best choice, like I was saying, but I noticed there are more French noir writers maybe, and maybe it's just more of a French thing. Hmm. I mean, obviously it's named, you know, noir,
right,
and came from France in some way. So maybe that's just more of a French sensibility. My books that, let's see, which ones, I think I have three of them published in France, three. I don't know. I'd have to look at my bookshelf, but Miami Purity has been reprinted there several times. They must really like that one. And maybe I just know the French noir women because my publisher is a noir publisher and that's why I've heard of them. But I don't know. We have NoirCon. We used to have NoirCon every 2 years in Philadelphia. Have you heard of it?
You know, I've heard of it. Tell me about it, because I've never been and I've always been interested. And I'm in California. It's in Philly. Right, I'm from the Philly area. So I want to go one day. So tell me.
Well, we were supposed to have one in 2018. And then one of the organizers, dearly beloved, was died and it got canceled for that year. And then we were supposed to have it in 2020, and you know what happened with that year. So it's actually, there hasn't been one since 2016, but it used to be GoodisCon before then, and I'm not sure what year it started, but I think I've gone to like six of them. So that's a while if you only go every other year. Maybe I've gone to more than that. And we really, and I really hope you make it, because the 2016 one, I counted a total of four women in the audience of a couple hundred. Hmm. And two of them, I believe, were wives of some local people that decided to come to the conference. And the other two were writers. Hmm. So, you know, it's, and yeah, there's a few other noir writers around, but just not very many noir women. And so we desperately need more. I just read a book by Haley Sutton. She just wrote a noir, I think it came out last November. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there are a couple more around. Megan Abbott was always my favorite, but she's kind of gone in more into horror. And, you know, I don't know, if she was very noir her first couple of books, but she's kind of branched out and gotten more popular because of it, I think. She's a great writer, but, you know, noir just doesn't get it. And let's see, S.J. Roseanne has been called noir, but she's more, I think, hard-boiled too. Mm-hmm. Krista Faust she's more erotica and hard boiled. I don't know, but they're just, and I probably don't know all of the women right now that are around, but I mean, it's just not that popular with women, either readers or writers, I don't think.
Why do you think we're attracted to different genres? I mean, like, if if a writer knows, okay, I like the mystery genre, and I want to sell books, can you make yourself, do you think you can make yourself go into that genre? I mean, if like, say, romantic thrillers is a hot genre, or domestic thrillers right now, I mean, do you think a writer can just transition to a more popular genre?
I guess it would depend on a writer. I don't know. My taste seems to run to things that very few people are interested in. So, you know, and I can't write about something that I really don't like that well, or a genre that I don't like that well. I don't know. The only reason I think that I continue to write books is because I get an idea and I have to see if it works. That seems to be the main thing. At this point, I'm not making much money in it. And it's really hard for me to keep my butt in the computer seat. It always has been. I don't really like writing. I like when it's finished. Mm-hmm. The book I'm working on now, I've been working on since, I think, like 2014. And I have to keep starting over because I, put it away for 6 months and then I can't even remember what I've got.
Right.
So the first half of it, I've probably got, 8 drafts. And then, maybe 6 drafts of the next quarter of it. And now I've only got a few scenes left to write and I'm trying to hang on and finish it, instead of stopping and then having to start over again. But I figure the first part is really good, you know? So once I finally complete the ending, I won't have to do that many drafts. I normally do about 8 drafts probably. And I've got at least 8 on the first half. So at least I'll save that time. Mm. But
How much do you need to know before you go in, before you start? You said you have an idea, you want to see if it works. Then what? I mean, are you a pantser, or will you plot it out a bit, or at least will you know where you hope to arrive at the end?
Sometimes I know where I hope to arrive, but I think that's why I really hate doing it so much, because most of it, I don't know where I'm going. It's kind of sentence by sentence, and something I'll say in a sentence, just a gesture I put in for a character makes me think that that character has a certain personality trait, which will then take me into some direction. And I mean, it all just feels so risky and chancy and coming out of nowhere that I think that's why I don't like to do it, because I never know whether I'll be able to finish it or not. And I always have finished everything up until this point. So I don't know why I keep thinking that, but same with short stories. In a short story, I do like to know the ending before I get very far. I really, because short stories are so much harder to end than novels. So I really try to know more about those. But I don't know what was I talking about?
What were we talking about? We were talking about how much you know going in, the plot or the structure.
Well, the ideas, usually, I get an idea at the start. It's usually having to do with a character. I've heard about somebody or met somebody that is an interesting character. And it starts me thinking about it. And then I think of some plot, like what if that person actually did this or something. I don't know. Iguana Love is a good example because, okay, Miami Purity was a little different because I had the model. And then, I don't know, I had a student that worked at a dry cleaner and she let me go there and hang out. And so that's how that got going. But Iguana Love, I met this woman who had an iguana as a pet because I had gotten an iguana as a pet. I don't know why. And I didn't know a thing about them. So she was selling this $3,000 iguana cage with a fountain and the special lighting and all this warmed rocks. And I don't know. And anyway, I went to see her, but I wasn't about to, you know, spend that on a cage. I really couldn't afford that, or, you know, that's not me. But I ended up talking to her and becoming her friend. And she was really obsessed with this iguana, which was already dead. That's why she had the cage for sale. But she had a lot of books, which I think she gave me. And, you know, we talked a lot about iguanas, and she had video of her dancing with the iguana on her shoulders. She had scars from the iguana biting her on the arms, and he'd been gone for a while. She had like a little monument to him on the windowsill with his name Chupa on there, which is like a sucker. Have you heard those Chupa suckers? So I don't know if that was because she thought he was sweet or he was sucking on her skin. I don't know, but she was an interesting, you know, kind of crazy person, and had some tattoos, I think, or those might've been other. I met other women with iguanas. It's kind of, I think, a cult. And a lot of them had tattoos. And this was really before tattoos got going. This was in the mid 90s, I guess. And I just took off from there, I think. And I was going to call it Iguana Woman. And then I started thinking about Iguana Love. she gave me this book that was, you know, one of those how-to books, how to raise your iguana or whatever, just a little thing that you buy in the pet store. And she had a line underlined in there. She also had little hearts drawn around on the pages. But she had a line, it was something like, no matter what you do, how much you love him, your iguana will never return your love. And that really gave me the whole idea for the book. And since it was noir, the main character was a woman, the man was an iguana that she was trying to get to return her love, but she couldn't return any love either. It was a whole, and she did get an iguana that couldn't return her love, a real iguana. So it was as really a, you know, unrequited love story, you know, with, thriller aspects and tons of sex in there also.
Well, I was going to say, and I have to read that one. That's one I haven't read of yours yet, but I have to say your writing is so uninhibited and raw. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, it sounds like that began in your MFA program.
I think I was encouraged by my instructor, Lynn Barrett. I took every class I could by her because she is the best reader and the best instructor that I could ever imagine. And the first class I took, it wasn't even a graduate course because I wasn't in yet. I was trying to, you know, I guess, see what you did in those places. I had a master's in English, but, you know, totally different. I was teaching already, but nothing like creative writing. And so I was in her class, and for some reason I wrote, I guess I was dating this guy who trimmed trees, but so I sort of did a kind of, you know, sex with the gardener type thing. Lady Chatterley's Lover, sort of, not really, but right. It was sort of that idea. And somebody in the class was shocked. And I don't remember what was so shocking about it now. I guess a sex scene, or I don't know what. And Lynn just stood up for me, and I could tell that she really enjoyed the sex. And that just made me feel so good, because I didn't feel like I really belonged in here yet or anything. And I think that spurred me on to start putting sex in the books. Plus, James M. Cain, you know, in his day, he couldn't really put much sex in there, but he was able to convey, you know, the sexiest stuff and get that feeling in there just with, you know, somebody biting a lip or you know, something along that line. And so I think, I don't know, somehow I got onto the idea that I was going to flesh it out more, so to speak.
So to speak.
And then, you know, I, of course, got accused of gratuitous sex off and on, but I really didn't care. I just thought, oh, that's good.
That brings up another point, and that is, what's the difference then between really uninhibited raw sex in fiction and pornography?
I don't know.
I mean, I wonder if
was
like your
of pornography.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yeah. Some library took my book off the shelf or something. And maybe there were more that I didn't hear of, but I heard about one. And I was supposed to go to do something somewhere in Alaska, and they had to change. It was a conference, and they would put you in the bush, they would say, and you would go out and, you know, do a talk or do something for people somewhere that were not really connected. And they decided, though they were too religious in those communities, somebody went on my website and I don't know, there were words that they didn't like. I don't know what it was, but there were a few people that were writing mysteries and detective. Lauren Henderson, who's a British writer, she got waved away at the airport when she, because you know, all these places in Alaska, they just have these little airports you fly in, and they told her to go away. And so and she was tired of eating moose anyway, so because some of these places were way out. So we then ended up at Fairbanks, I think, at the university, and did our thing there. And you know, it was really fun. And I don't know, I always just took it as fun. If people called it pornography, it I always just felt that the whole thing was fun. And I, you know, was the happiest I'd been making money and going around being creative and people wanting to talk to me. And, you know, I just, if they want to think it's pornography, I didn't really care.
You know,
sure, you know, didn't lose me any sales.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I was reading both of these books, Cruel Poetry and Miami Purity, I was thinking that one thing pornography, I would imagine, does not seem to have, or just, you know, straight erotica, is plot. I mean, you have like a story going on, which diffuses, I think, titillation, because now we're dealing with characters and motivation and their stories. And
and there's a lot of, you know, in a sex scene, you've got somebody with the power there that often plays into, you know, the characters and what's going on. So you can really do more than just put sex on the page. And I think that's what pornography is. It's just kind of flat sex without the subtext and the, you know, anything like that. So yeah, there's a difference, but if people are disgusted by it, and you know, then I guess they consider pornography. And I know I went overboard here and there because I enjoyed writing those scenes, and whatever.
Well, I'm curious if writing noir darkens your view of humanity. I mean, you sound very happy and upbeat. And, you know, I think sometimes people imagine, readers that don't know people who write noir, imagine them to have sort of a dark view.
They do. They really do. I can't tell you how many people were shocked that I was not you know, like my characters or, you know, and I'm not at all. I've always said I have a happy brain, and you know, now I'm really getting old. It's not as happy as it used to be, but I don't know. It's not real, you know, and I'm just trying to get inside people's heads that are twisted. And, you know, I know there must be some people that are twisted like that, but for the most part, it doesn't feel that real to me. You know, I'm just putting kind of a veneer of realness on it. And I don't think you really believe noir when you're reading it. And there's even a, you know, it's more of a dark comedy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I'm not a dark character at all. I've done some crazy things, but you know, and scuba diving and skydiving, those were thrilling times in my life, which was really my research at that point. You know, I never had to look anything up. This one I'm working on now is driving me crazy because I have to become an expert in architecture and I can't tell you how many things, but luckily there's YouTube now that we didn't have when I was out there scuba diving and skydiving. So
do you do your research as you go along, or do you feel like you have to do a certain amount before you begin?
This is probably the first book that I've ever done real research on. And well, no, I did a little for Fur People, which has a big animal hoarding component. And I looked up a lot about how many animals are killed in shelters and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But mostly, you know, that's just a little bit that comes out in the book. Most of it is a woman living in a school bus in the woods. And by the way, I moved from Hollywood. I'm in Central Florida now. So, and that's where Fur People takes place, in the woods and in Central Florida. And so there's a lot of nature and animals and things in there. But what was I saying again? See, I told you, I just go on and on.
It's good. It's good.
Don't find my way back.
Well, we have a few minutes left anyway. And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but I'm with Vicki Hendricks, and this show will be podcast sometime in the next couple of weeks. And if you go to iTunes and you subscribe to Writers on Writing, when it's podcast, it will pop into your file and you'll be able to hear it from the beginning. I did want to ask you, though, because you write short stories and novels, how do you know when an idea has enough traction for a novel? Or do you know even, you know, I'm in the mood to write a short story, what should I write about? Let's see, I'm going to write about that. Or do you have the idea and you go, no, that's this or that's that?
Well, I was really taught, more like what you're saying, that there are certain things that are worthy of a poem. There are things that will be a short story, and then there are other things, you know, that can be novels. And it has to do with like the depth of the pond, you know. And I remember some conference I went to, can't think of this guy's name. Oh, Barry Hanna was saying,
oh, sure,
talking about students that would come in with something for a novel. And there just wouldn't be enough complexity at the start. And he was saying, you know, this dog won't hunt, which I always love that. That's the first time I heard that expression, that dog won't hunt or whatever. And so I guess it's more of a feeling. And maybe the more you write, the more you know. Because when I do a short story, I kind of know how many pages it's going to be. I mean, I have an idea. And sometimes you have to cram a little in there because people don't want your short stories to be so long. I've mostly written my stories because being a female noir writer, there are so few that anybody who puts out a noir anthology, or many of them, think, oh, Vicki Hendricks. And they ask me to write one for them. Sure. You know, you know, being among a small population gets you a lot of work. So most of them, but sometimes I would just write one and then somebody would ask me and I would have it. That was a weird thing that happened a couple of times. People would ask me for stories that, and there was some kind of theme, and I would already have one that I'd written that fit into it. Like the one about the penis. What the heck was the name of that? Ugh, I can't remember. It was a collection. Maybe her name will come to me. Fiona, somebody. It was done, you know, in the 90s. And it was, the premise was if a woman had a penis, you know, a story with a woman with a penis. And I had just written Iguana Love, where the woman grows one on steroids. So I didn't really take part out of Iguana Love, but I was all set there. You know, I just wasn't a problem. And, you know, other funny things like that have happened, but I don't know. I just now have a sense. Well, I kind of always had a sense of what would be a short story as opposed to a novel. And I can't really tell you, maybe just from reading so many short stories and so many novels.
Yeah. What about Gators, that's in Miami Noir? Where did that story come from? And did you know it was a story to begin with? Yeah. Love this story.
A lot of my stories have come about being inspired by old boyfriends. And that one in particular. Now, I have to say, I exaggerated him a little bit. but the raw material was there. and he was actually kind of flattered that I would write about him. And he actually appeared in Voluntary Madness too. Mm. But I have to say that I did kind of adventure dating, I think. You know, I was married at a young age, had a son, and then got a divorce, and then was you know, single for like 25 years or something. And so there were a lot of adventure dates in there. And I just thought of it as it was material, you know, whatever you're doing, it's all material.
Right, right, right.
And I got a lot out of some of them. And they're, you know, disguised generally, but that one, and that's really, what was I saying? And oh, the penis thing and the, I don't know, the boyfriend thing. I guess when you're working kind of from a real person, it also, you have a lot of material for a novel, you know, it gives you a good base. And I've also been good at hearing about people from other people. There's something about hearing it secondhand, which was Miami Purity. The main character in there was a stripper that one of my ex-boyfriends knew intimately. And I got a bunch of details from her life. And so I don't know, I can't explain the process or how I know a novel from a short story, but it's, you know, it seems to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love your stuff. And it's just been a major delight to have you on the show. I really appreciate your time. And I have a couple of more.
I thought I would be struggling, but
I know you did.
And here comes a cat right on cue.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Vicki, for taking the time. And
sure. Yeah, it was really fun. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
All right. Talk to you later.
That was Vicki Hendricks. Her books are Cruel Poetry, Miami Purity, Iguana Love, Voluntary Madness. She has stories here and there. Miami Noir is a wonderful collection. I have the classics right on my desk, and her story Gators is in this one. In any case, we'll be back here next week. Thank you for being here with us, and stay safe and get your writing done too.
Someday when we're older, with gray hair and smile lines, we'll pour off on the shoulder, we'll be words that read signs. I hope we get lost on the way to our grandchildren's place. We can lie, say we took the wrong way, waste an hour like we did each day. Waste an hour like